Well, you'll see on the screen there a picture of my family. My name is Dan Jarvis, and some of my family is here today. Melissa, you can wave. You don't have to stand up. Then I've got a few of my boys here in the room and a couple in the classes back there and a few back in Michigan where we're from. The reason Melissa isn't standing up is she is currently pregnant with triplets. So that picture is going to get a lot more complicated in about maybe as soon as a month from now, but hopefully at least 2 months from now. That's our goal. So triplets come early, just sort of automatically. So we're not sure how early they'll come, but we're sort of in the final stretch of that. And so our lives for the last 11 or 12 years have been certainly defined by the idea of loving one more. We didn't have any sort of master plan to build a family the way we have when we started. It was just when Melissa and I just had gotten married, we had in mind that our household, we wanted to use it as a basis for our mission in life. And part of that being to extend hospitality, to be a haven for people in need, and particularly kids in need. That had been on both of our hearts early in life. In fact, Melissa had read George Mueller's biography as a little girl, and that had been sort of a dream that had lived in her heart to have an orphanage or something someday. And so we didn't know how that would work out, but when we settled in our home in Ohio at the time, now we live in Michigan, we thought, well, we'll sign up for our county's foster parent classes, and thinking maybe we'd do that for a few years and then move on with life and go a different direction. But as God would have it, some of the kids that came into our home ended up being permanent, and so over the course of years, we fostered many kids, probably about 40. Six of those have joined our forever family, and then you also see our most recent addition in the middle of the picture there, William. He's back in the nursery now. He's 19 or 20 months currently. And then we've got three more coming. So that's our synopsis, our story. Pastor Roddy mentioned that I pastor a church in Michigan now, and also work with Life Action. And both of those, we just count a privilege to be able to be a part of the ministry. And through both of those, we have a little bit of flexibility to go and share our story and cast the vision for loving one more to other churches. And so I'm really excited to be here this morning to do that with all of you. So I have a question for all of you kids in the room. How many of you play with Legos? Go ahead and admit it. All right. Adults, you can raise your hands too, because I know how it works. I'm one of you. How many of you know that you typically, you know, Legos are really fun to play with and put together. They're not so fun to put away. Anybody on board with that too? Okay. So here's what I have discovered about in our house right now. We have a basement playroom, and that's where all the Legos live. We try to enforce that because loose Legos and little babies and all through the main area of the house would not be a good scenario. So we try to keep all the Legos downstairs. But occasionally, as a parent, either Melissa or I will get just sort of fed up with the crazy thick mess that represents that playroom downstairs, and we'll say we have to at least vacuum. So everybody go downstairs and pick up all the Legos and all the other little toys. And there's a certain sound that seems like it crosses cultures. Like anywhere around the world, if you ask a whole bunch of kids to pick up, they all make the same sound. It's kind of like, oh, do we have to? Do I really have to? And so kids, just if you're here now, why don't you help us out? Can you go ahead and make that sound? Just pretend that I'm your dad for a second, and I asked you to go pick up 1,000 Legos on the floor. What are you going to say? Oh. All right, so at our house, I have noticed over the years, different kids will master different ways of sort of handling that command. Some will go down and begrudgingly, you know, throw a couple Legos in the big Rubbermaid container and then get caught up playing with some of them and forget that it was cleanup time. Other kids will be very once in a great while, somebody will buy into the actual principle, and they'll be like, yes, I want a clean room, and it'll actually get clean. Most of the time, what I'll get, especially if they're looking at like this minefield of littered debris that is like obviously a really big job, is, Dad, how many Legos do I have to pick up? And so I never quite know how to answer that, like all of them, or maybe I said, like, how about 10,000? You start with that, see where you're at the end of that. But what they're looking for is that when that question is sort of born out of I'm not exactly interested in actually getting the room clean, but I do know I have to follow this, like, I have to do what you're saying, so what's the minimum I can get away with? Give me that, I'll do it, and then I'm off back to my own plan in life. And so sometimes we'll actually give them like a little chart or a little checkbox list, and we'll say, okay, you know, here's, you know, child A, you need to pick up 100 Legos, and after you've done that, you can go play, or so little things like that. And sometimes I'll go and I'll kind of check on progress, and I'll see, you know, sometimes they're rooting around in the carpet fibers, getting the small ones and actually sort of doing the job. Other times, you know, you kind of see kid will take a fully built like little ship or something and kind of look at it and go, well, that's probably 100, and just throw it in the box and, you know, we're good to go. So, you know, there's all sorts of ways to handle it. What I notice, though, is that my heart has a similar reaction to things that I don't necessarily want to do, but if I feel like I'm supposed to do it, I'll kind of ask, what's my minimum? What do I have to do? All right, so turn in the Bible to Luke 10. And there's a guy in the scripture here who asks Jesus a question. He doesn't exactly like Jesus' answer. And I feel like what he ultimately does is ask, it kind of makes that sound, do I really have to do this? Or what's sort of the minimum I could get away with? But not how many Legos do I have to pick up, but like, who do I really have to love? Like, I'm willing to love. I get that that's part of the deal here, but what's the minimum I could do? All right, we'll pick up the story in chapter 10, verse 25. One day, an expert in religious law stood up to test Jesus by asking him this question. Teacher, what must I do to inherit eternal life? Jesus replied, well, what does the law of Moses say? How do you read it? The man answered, you must love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, all your strength, all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Right, Jesus told him, do this and you will live. The man wanted to justify his actions, so he asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? Do I really have to love everybody? I mean, aren't there some people that the command just doesn't specify it, does it? I mean, love your neighbors yourself, and you're kind of like, well, okay, certain neighbors I'm good with, certain kinds of neighbors I'm okay loving. Maybe people in certain parts of town or people in certain countries in the world, I'm okay with that. But like, how wide-ranging is this command to love my neighbor? Or what's the minimum amount of love that I have to put out before I can go back to doing my own thing? Because really, I have my own agenda in life. And I realize I'm supposed to love, so just tell me the minimum. Like, five neighbors? Great. I'll go check the boxes. We'll have them all over for dinner. And done. We did our love for the year. Now we're back to whatever we wanted to do. So rather than answering this guy's question, Jesus did commonly what he does do. He tells a story to illustrate the answer. And here's that story, which you'll recognize as soon as we start to read it. It says, well, a Jewish man was traveling from Jerusalem down to Jericho, and he was attacked by bandits. They stripped him. They beat him of his clothes, or they ripped his clothes off. They beat him. They left him half dead beside the road. By chance, a priest came along. But when he saw the man lying there, he crossed to the other side of the road and passed him by. And you say, wow, of all the people that should be able to reach out and love a stranger who's in desperate need, really at death's door, you would think that the people that work at the church would be ready, and that of anybody, like maybe they would have some room in their schedule to care about somebody in need, right? But nope, this priest, he walks right on by, and so we wait. We wait for someone to come along who would care. So then you go, good news, a different person from the church is coming by. It says a temple assistant this time. Surely this person is going to be able to stop by and like minister to this guy, or at least, you know, call 911 or something. But no, the temple assistant walked over, looked at him lying there, but he did nothing. He passed by on the other side. I saw a picture of what people think this road would have actually been, and it wasn't like some sort of wide eight-line highway. This was sort of a footpath, so like to walk by on the other side, you're kind of walking up there, and you would have had to kind of like step around and keep moving. I mean, just literally, this is not like they kind of missed it. It wasn't in the corner of their eye, or they were so busy texting and walking, they just went walk. No, they had to step over this guy and move past. So finally, there's some hope. A different person comes by, but not a church worker. In fact, no one that a Jew would have expected to help. One of these lowly, despised Samaritans, the other culture that was nearby that they had just grown to hate for all different reasons. says this, this despised Samaritan came along, and when he saw the man, he felt compassion for him, and going over to him, the Samaritan soothed his wounds with olive oil and wine and bandaged them, and then he put the man on his own donkey and took him to an inn where he took care of him. The next day he handed the innkeeper 2 silver coins, telling him, take care of this man. If his bill runs higher than this, I'll pay him the next time I'm here. Now, which of these three would you say was a neighbor to the man who was attacked by the bandits? Jesus asked. The man replied, well, the one who showed him mercy. Then Jesus said, yes, now go and do the same. It's interesting that Jesus turns the question the other way around. So what the guy was asking was, like, tell me the minimum, like, which neighbors do I have to love? Who exactly is my neighbor? And Jesus says, no, no, that's not how you ask the question. The question is, will you be a neighbor? It's not who is my neighbor out there. Everybody is your neighbor. Will you be a neighbor to the people in need? Will you be a neighbor to the people who need love? So you love your neighbor as yourself. This means you look around and everybody qualifies. And you say, wow, well, if I'm the kid that doesn't really want to pick up the Legos, and I'm looking at my to-do list, and it just has this open-ended, keep loving your neighbor forever, you're like, oh, man, I mean, you, oh, Lord, really? I mean, when do I get to go back to my own agenda here? But if you're the person who buys in to God's agenda, and you see the bigger picture, you see that this is the purpose of life, to love, then you look and you say, of course I want to love my neighbor. I want to love anyone I can. Like with the lifetime I'm given, that's the point of my life, is to love. There's no other reason I'm here. Love God and love other people. And so, yeah, Lord, I don't need you to give me some sort of minimum. Just anyone who I come across, I'll be a neighbor to that person. That's the heart of this whole Good Samaritan parable, right? It's that rather than ask, what's the minimum required distribution of my love that I have to do? Instead, you say, no, I'm not even worried about that. Like, what's the maximum amount of love I could possibly offer? How could I find more people to love? And that brings us to our theme. It brings us to the challenge that's implied in the very title of what we're doing this weekend, that for all of us, there is one more in your life, or maybe not into your life yet, that God would call you to love. And then there's one more after that, and one more after that. And the joy of it is that the list of people to love never has to dry up. It never has to end, which means that you never have to go through even one day of your life lacking purpose. You never have to get to the place where you're like, wow, I think my life's kind of over. I've already done everything I'm supposed to do. It'll never happen because there's always more neighbors out there. There's always the next person that you could say, yes, Lord, I'm willing to love that person with the love that you've given me. All right, so a few principles, and I also want to give you a math problem. So I'll ask kids another question. How many of you love math? It's not quite as enthusiastic as the Lego question, right? All right, well, this is sort of like spiritual Bible verse math. So I'm going to give you a little equation here and see if you can work it out. So we're going to add a couple Bible verse concepts together and see what the result is. First of all, we already heard the second greatest commandment, which is love your neighbor as yourself. That means with the same care and attention that you would pay to yourself or to your own family or your own agenda, say, I'm supposed to actually love my neighbor that way. Great. That's the first part of the equation. Next part, James 1:27. That's the verse that says, religion that God accepts as pure and faultless is this, to care for widows and orphans in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Say, well, of all the different needy populations that could have been mentioned, James singles out widows and orphans as sort of an example of pure religion. Pure religion, you care about those people. Like, well, why would that be? I mean, he could have mentioned other potentially needy populations. I look at widows and orphans and think maybe the reason that was mentioned, especially knowing the culture this was written into, where there wasn't any social safety net to catch any of those people, these were people who could never pay you back. These were the most needy. These were the people that would only take from you and never in any kind of tangible or financial way be able to give anything back to you. Widows and orphans, there's no income, there's no potential for income, there's no way this works out in your favor as the one that's like, hey, well, I think I'll help you for a few years and you can help me back. It's not going to happen. Pure religion is when you can love the people in greatest need and never ask for anything in return. Okay, so that's part of our equation here. The last part of the equation is Matthew 6:33. where Jesus said, "Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all the things you need will be added to you as well." So the food, the clothes, the shelter, the things that you need, that you would worry about, Jesus says, if you're focusing on his priorities instead of your own, God will take care of those practical things. So here's why each part of this equation is important, and here's what it adds up to. We know we're supposed to love our neighbor, but then when you add James 1:27, you go, wait a minute, I'm supposed to love not just all the neighbors, yes, but focus in on the most needy and difficult ones. Say, well, okay, I get that, but like if I do that, I'm going to run out of money. Like I'm going to run out of time and energy and heartbeat. Like I can't possibly take on the worst cases and the most needy and the people that will never pay me back and it'll never work out on the balance sheet. How am I supposed to keep loving them forever? Like that seems like the math won't work. That's why you need the next part of the equation. Matthew 6:33 says that when you're putting God's priorities first, he actually provides for your needs. So here's how I work this equation out and what I believe that it calls us into. A life where you would say, a heartbeat where you would say, I will love one more, especially those most in need, trusting in God to provide. So it's not that you start from a position of like wisdom and riches and all this and you go, okay, now I'm ready to love people because I've totally got it made in this world. I have plenty of extra money in my budget. I have a massive house with all these extra bedrooms. We've already got the big, you know, stretch suburban in the driveway. We're totally good to go. Let's love some people. No, this actually starts where you don't have the resources yourself to do it. You may not have enough for your family. But you're saying, Lord, I will step into this love lifestyle of thinking about my neighbor, even when I don't have my own life totally worked out, because the resource from which you will love your neighbor is not going to be your resource anyway. God will provide for what you need if you say yes to his kingdom priorities. So we found in our family, like this has worked out in crazy, miraculous ways over and over and over again. We could spend the whole afternoon just kind of recounting stories of miraculous provisions of houses and vehicles and food and diapers. And in any time that we've sort of stepped up and said, okay, like I'm not quite sure how it'll work, but yes, we will love one more, somehow God provides through people, sometimes people we wouldn't have even expected or wouldn't have even known our situation that well. Somehow God provides in amazing ways. And things somehow work out. And I look at it and go, I would not have known to plan for this. I wouldn't have had the skills to plan for it. Wouldn't have had the income to sustain any of this. And yet somehow God provides. It's Matthew 6:33. That's why it's in the equation. So that little math problem there, to me, kind of results in the love one more challenge. Would you look at that math problem in your life and say, Lord, I actually trust you, and I trust what those three scriptures say. On that basis, I'll say yes. Yes, Lord, I'm willing to love my neighbor as much as I love myself. I'm willing to love my neighbor's kid as much as I love my kid. I'm willing to love my neighbor's widow or grandma as much as I would love her if she was in my own family. I will set my own self aside and love other people like that. So I've got a few concepts that I want to introduce this morning, and then tonight we'll work on some applications of how we can play this out in our lives. So just thinking about the love one more challenge, for our family, that has been largely defined by foster care and adoption. But I would say the challenge here in the scripture isn't just to that. This is having eyes that see need and want to extend love and hospitality and generosity in any direction. So you start thinking through, in my life, like God may call you to all sorts of ways that you could love one more. There might be thousands of ways that are possible for you to extend love to other people. So you just start saying, Lord, who is the next one? The next one more. Sometimes we'll joke about it among our family with our kids because sometimes I forget which one it was. Maybe one of the ones that's sitting there. I won't say which one. But one of the kids noticed that I was like being really nice to somebody else, like somebody. And he kind of sighed and said, Dad, is this like one of those one mores. I was like, yeah, I guess it is. You know, it was kind of like when you get into the spirit of it, hopefully you're not having to like calculate it all the time. It just becomes a little bit automatic that you're extending love. But yeah, everybody's a one more. There's always the opportunity to just take one more person and bring them into the circle. And the way I like to think of it is like there's sort of this circle of close friends and family, people you would do anything for, people that, like if it was your brother who was on the road to, in between Samaria and Jericho or whatever, and they had fell, you know, your brother was the one attacked by bandits and you were walking by, would you walk by your own brother on the side of the road? Well, no. I mean, that's family. You'd do anything for that guy. Well, that's the spirit that we're called to. That's the love your neighbor as yourself. So you start to look at other people and say, I'm going to treat people as if they were near and dear to me. Like so the child who doesn't have a home to go to, I would be willing to treat that child as if they were my own child. Or the person who's lonely that you know from work or school that no one else cares about, you say, I want to treat that person as if that person was in my own family. How would I treat them? The maybe the person that nobody likes or nobody can get along with, or for whatever reason is just sort of a person that you'd rather stay away from. You say, what if that person was in my own family? Could I love them like that? That's the kind of love Jesus calls us to engage in. So challenge might be worded like this. It's adding one more to my circle of family and close friends out of the overflow of God's love for me. There are 8 billion people in the world. You'd say, I can't even begin to meet all the needs that I just know about. Like, there's way too many people out there. The needs are way too complicated. And I agree. There's a lot of people. I don't think there's too many, but there's a lot of complicated needs out there. Here's the reality, though. God hasn't called you to tackle all those 8 billion people's worth of needs at one time. But he can call you to love one more. And he fully has equipped you to do that. If only you say, yes, Lord, I'm willing to love one more. I'm willing to add one person to the Thanksgiving table. I'm willing to add one person into my car when I'm driving to church. I'm willing to add one person to my schedule this week to have lunch with. I'm willing to add one more child who needs an extra place to go to come over and visit with my kids, or whatever it might be. There's 1,000 ways to play it out. But Lord, would you just help me find out how I can love one more, and then one more after that. So how do I get started? This is where I'd like to land it this morning in preparation for tonight. How do I begin a love one more lifestyle? I put the radar screen up there because I think this is a good way to imagine how it can work. I get this from John 4, where Jesus was in Samaria. So you've got the same cultural dynamic where the disciples who were Jews were walking through Samaria, and they're just kind of thinking like, oh, everything here is sort of icky. I don't want to be a part of these people. I don't like them. I just want to get through this part of town and on to my own life. And so they're sort of head down, trudging along. Let's get this over with. Jesus, on the other hand, apparently is looking around, is seeing people for who they are, and he sees this woman drawing water at the Samaritan well. And he goes up and strikes up a conversation, which was weird for multiple reasons. She was a woman. He was a man. To make a direct address in that culture would have been a little bit awkward. But then even more so, he's a Jew. She's Samaritan. Why are you bothering me? Why are you talking about me or with me? And so one thing leads to another. Jesus ends up witnessing to this lady. She ends up believing that he's the Messiah, runs back to her village to tell everyone that she knows, I have found the Messiah. So this is like this is an amazing moment here for the gospel. The disciples in that moment were completely not tuned in to what God was doing. They were worried about lunch, and so they had gone off to buy food. And they come back, and then they're kind of like grumbling, like, okay, well, why are you talking to this lady? You know, come on, I thought we were just trying to get it, like, let's get back on schedule here, Lord. And he says something to them that I think could shake us up a little bit if we really hear it in our own context. So look down to verse 32, after they're saying, Jesus, you need to eat something here, and then let's get going. Jesus replied, I have a kind of food you know nothing about. Did someone bring him food while we were gone? The disciples asked each other. Then Jesus explained, my nourishment comes from doing the will of God who sent me, from finishing his work. You know the saying, 4 months between planting and harvest. But I say, wake up and look around. The fields are already ripe for harvest. So here are these disciples, in theory, that they are training to be missionaries. Like, they're training to lead the church of the future. So they're supposed to be fully tuned in to, like, the gospel and sharing the gospel with people, and they are missing this incredible opportunity that they're literally about to walk past because they're not looking for opportunity. They're focused on their own agenda. And Jesus says to them, wake up and look around. Like, you're thinking it's 4 months from now and then we get started? No, no. Right now, today, the field is ripe. Right now, there are opportunities. And that field was ripe. You keep reading the narrative there. That woman comes back, basically brings the whole village with her. And after they all got to know Jesus, basically there's this mass conversion. This whole village starts to follow Jesus just because his radar was on. And he saw that woman at the well. And he used it not only as an opportunity to give the gospel to that village, but to give the disciples a lesson that you never get so fixated on your next step for yourself that you miss the fact that there are people all around you who need love. And here's this woman who needed love. Jesus extended it, and a great thing resulted. So wake up and look around. That's kind of like, in our lingo, turn on your radar. And start to realize that if you were to send out sort of an active ping in here, I guess that's sonar, but active ping, and you might even realize in this room there might be some people that need love from you. And it's just a matter of being intentional and deciding that, yes, you will look for that. You'll have your eyes open. You'll be awake to the opportunities that God might bring to you to love. Okay, so here's sort of where you can look. And I think it's a lot of fun to imagine that as you go through life as an agent of God's love, there are opportunities everywhere. Like, you'll never run out of work to do if you think of it this way. So first of all, you look here. You look at the people that are right in front of you and say, are there already people in my life who are like the one more that I need to love? We were at a church somewhere in the South, I forget where, maybe it was North Carolina, and shared this challenge to love one more, and a lady came up after the service and said, I know my one more is my stepson that lives with me. Like, okay, well, fill in the blanks. Well, here there was this complicated, sad divorce scenario, and this woman had so much bitterness against the scenario that the stepson who ended up living with her in her house, she was like knowingly pushing aside, cold shoulder, don't want anything to do with him. And here this woman said, I know the one more for me to love is actually a kid that already lives with me in my house, that she just had not been letting her heart love this kid because of her own bitternesses and other issues. And so it could be that there's already people in your life, like somebody who literally could be sitting next to you at school, or could be right there next to you on the job, or someone who lives physically in the house next door that's already in your life that you could start intending to love the way that Jesus would call you to. Okay, but you say, well, what if I'm doing okay with that? Like, I feel like I do love the people in my life. I mean, obviously, we can all upgrade all that, but let's just grant that you're doing okay. Well, so I've looked around here. Now let's start looking around there. Like, where else could I be? So looking there is like the mission groups and the external opportunities. You know, you're saying, okay, my church, and through my church, there's all sorts of opportunities to extend love. Pastor Rodney and I were just talking about in the break that there's the Baptist Children's Home up in Michigan that you connect with as a church. Opportunity to love. It's not people that you're necessarily going to see every day, but it's a way that you could love one more simply by signing up to be a part of that kind of thing. And there's a thousand other things like that. I have a friend in New York who he's grown up his whole life right next to the Great Lakes and just always sort of take it for granted that we've got fresh water everywhere in the Midwest of the U.S., but other places in the world don't have that, or they don't have access to it very easily. And so he started to read about the villages in Africa and India and places that don't have fresh water, and they have to, you know, hike down to little canals or whatever and pull water out with buckets, and it's dirty and it's infested and it's diseased. And so he started this little club he calls Freshwater Friends, and he just said, what if we just get together this little club, we'll try to raise money and we'll see how many water wells we can dig, like in partnership with other organizations out there that do that. And so over the course of a few years, like his little club has dug like 45 wells. That might even be more now. And just again by being intentional. So you're looking around, Lord, who's already next to me? You look here, like in the church and community, start looking out there, like where are some ways I could extend love maybe beyond my normal circle of influence through missions or through compassion projects I could get involved in. And then what's fun is, and this would be sort of the Good Samaritan story, is you also need to look out, because as soon as you say yes to God and you really start acting as his loving agent in the world, he is going to bring people into your life that you would not expect, like you would never have known. So just like this Samaritan man, like he didn't set out on his daily mission with the thought of getting totally sidetracked and ending up paying for somebody's hotel and doing medical care or whatever, but he was ready when the moment came. He was tuned in, his radar was on. So what would happen to our lives if we turn on the radar and we say, Lord, like practically when I can, I'm going to love people even without a special prompting. I'm just going to go ahead and say, yes, I'll do that. But then I'm ready, Lord, for you to like, you know, if there is a ping back, like if there is like, oh, wow, there's something there. There's someone who needs a touch. I'm willing to be that agent. God will give you opportunities. One that I recall that was kind of life-defining in some ways for me as a kid was the day that my parents got a phone call. I grew up in a Christian home after I was age 11. Before that, there was it's a whole different story, but my dad had a really rough drugs and alcohol thing going on, and there was, you know, near collapse of my family. Divorce was being talked about, and then Jesus came in, and my dad became a Christian, and everything changed. And so then shortly after that, my parents were, as new Christians, trying to live this stuff out, and as a young teen, I got to kind of watch them grow in their faith. It was a really neat dynamic. And they got a call about a family from the then-collapsing Soviet Union. This was the early 90s, that they were somehow stuck at the McDonald's in Brunswick, Ohio, trying to sleep there because it was a 24-hour one, and they had nowhere to go. So, okay, there's got to be more of a story to this. So we find out that they had been from one part of the former Soviet Union that had broken off from another part, but because of their ethnicity didn't match where they lived, they actually weren't allowed to go home. And the place they were allowed to go, which would have been just like back to Russia, they didn't have anything there, so they were kind of stuck, and they were stuck in the U.S. because they had been visiting, and they had spent down all of their travel money, and they had now nothing. So I think there's no credit, there's no bank, there's just no options, and here they are, and they kind of almost have no country. And so, you know, first instinct is like maybe we call the homeless shelter or find somebody out there in the government that can handle this. And I was really glad that that wasn't my parents' first instinct. Their first instinct was, well, let's invite them over. Like, we don't want them to be at McDonald's all night. Like, they could at least come to our house. So one thing led to another, and probably within just a couple days, we had decided to go ahead and host this family, and we were going to help them get through the legal process of figuring out what to do next. And in the meantime, like, we kind of activated our church family who came in and did like a quick renovate of our basement to get it ready for some people to live in there. And just all of a sudden, like, you know, look out here. Now we've got a family of three that hardly speaks any English living in our basement. And I'm so grateful my parents said yes to that opportunity to love three more in that circumstance, because that had a huge impact on my perception of hospitality, of what it means to be responsive to opportunities for God, maybe take even some risks and do some things that other people might say, oh, that's a little bit too extreme or that's a little bit too crazy. We had such fun times with that family. I think they lived with us for about 8 months while we got them set up with a employer sponsor. They ended up coming here permanently, and now they live over in Cleveland, Ohio. I get to see them once in a very great while, and it's always a neat little reunion. They remember me as like a 13-year-old kid, and now it's kind of neat to go back and compare notes with them. But we had such good times. The hilarious thing, and this is where when you're this becomes an adventure. Like we talk about it like it's all sacrifice, and it's all, but like you get a lot in return when you're involved in people's lives, and there's a lot of fun to this. So the Russian guy, one day he said to me, Daniel, you need to learn chess. And he said he had all these stories about how in Russia they play chess, and he talked about how they would go into the sauna on the weekend, and they'd wrap the white towels, and all the men would go in, they'd steam it up, and they'd go in until they couldn't breathe, and they'd go out, get some fresh air, go back into the sauna, and play chess the whole time. He said, well, okay. I mean, that is kind of what I imagine when I imagine Russia, I guess. So, sure, teach me. So he painstakingly was teaching me all these moves in chess and everything. And each afternoon, we had this chess lesson. I think it was like one of the ways that he was, like, we were doing a lot for his family. And he was trying, like, what value can he give back? So sometimes he would cook special pierogies or borscht or whatever for us. And he'd make a big Russian feast and tell us stories about what it was like living under communism. I mean, it was an amazing experience to have in our house. It was probably like you could make a movie about it, and it would even be mildly entertaining because it was just a neat time. And I look at all those experiences and think that all came down to my parents in that moment of decision when they found out there was a need. Instead of thinking who else can meet the need, that just the first, sometimes it is right to pass a need forward. I don't think you should meet every single need, but I do think you can be interested in meeting every single need, and you can at least ask in your heart, Lord, is this something I should do? And so when you decide to say yes to this call, and you say, Lord, in whatever way you're going to prompt me, I'm willing to love one more, that opportunities will come, and God will use your willingness, and he will provide. And you just think back to the equation. As soon as you start having all the worry, like, well, wait, if I really engage with people, I don't have time, I don't have money, I'm already feel like I'm overwhelmed. God will provide. And tonight we'll talk about how God does that a little bit. But what he's looking for from us is not all the answers and not everything lined up ahead of time. He's just asking us to say yes to his call. And when we do that, we find out the road forward. So as we go this morning, here are two practical things you can think about that maybe even today in the context of this afternoon would be a little opportunity to put it into practice. Okay, two things that can help you have your radar on. Maybe two different kinds of radar, I guess. One is look for empty chairs around you. So you could glance around and realize there's a few empty chairs, even like literally right next to you right now. And then when you get in your car on the way home, you're probably going to notice there's a few empty chairs in your car. And then you'll have lunch somewhere and you might look around and you say, oh, there's a few empty chairs here at lunch. You might even go home and there might even be an empty bedroom at your house. Okay, so think of all those empty places as opportunities. And you say, Lord, I don't know how you want to use these empty chairs, but if you want to use them, they're available. Okay, that's step one. So now you're looking at your car a little differently. You're like, wow, I'm glad I've got an extra seat there. What if someone who I've never even met before is supposed to sit in that seat this week that I reach out to somehow? Or what if there's someone who would be around our dining room table later this week that you know, I've never really reached out to before? What if there's someone who is supposed to sit in church with me next week that I've never invited before? And you just start thinking about all those empty chairs that are all around you as resources that you have available to love one more, as to get started. All right, so now here's the other way to turn your radar on is to just do a little bit of a prayer walk around the places that are in your life. And it's nothing complicated. It's just a prayer walk where your eyes are open, where you're thinking what Jesus said, like wake up and look around. So walk through your workplace awake and looking around at the people there. Say, Lord, is there anyone here that could be my one more that I love somehow this week? Or walk through your school and just say, Lord, like as everybody's, you know, hustle and bustle, moving things around in their lockers, teachers are doing their thing, is there anyone here in the scope of how far out my radar reaches that you want me to extend your love to this week? It could be that you make it formal and you say, you know, maybe God actually does prompt you to sign up for foster care somehow locally or some sort of an adoption process. That's great. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do this, but it starts by just flipping your radar on and saying, Lord, I'm willing, and now I'm watching. And as you bring people into my sight that I could extend your love to, you can count on me, Lord. I'll say yes in that moment. And he'll give you the resources you need. So tonight we'll talk more about this. But for now, why don't we pray and ask for God to give us his courage, his wisdom, to be able to go ahead, to go forward with the love one more vision in our hearts. Lord, thank you for giving us endless opportunities to fulfill the purposes of our lives, that we never have to run out of motivation or joy, because every day is filled with opportunity to love more neighbors as we've been loved by you, to extend your kind of love into the hearts of others. We have opportunities inside our own families, in our schools, in our workplaces, through community agencies, through church ministries, through mission agencies, or really everywhere we turn, there are opportunities, because everywhere we turn, there are people, and every single one of them was created to love and to be loved. And we know that we are your agents of that love in the world, and especially to the circle of influence that you put us in. So help us, Lord, to take your call seriously, to no longer worry about our minimum contribution of love to others, but instead to think of, by faith, how we could extend even more love to one more. We look forward to doing that. In Jesus' name.